coronavirus and the ramifications, we've seen the markets sort of bounce back. But what does that tell us about the economy, particularly the global economy, how it may be affected?
So it doesn't tell you very much. The market has treated this as a containable, temporary, and reversible shock, just like the U.S. attack on an Iranian general, just like the attack on the Saudi oil production. That's how the market sees it. And it's supported in that view by nice comments about fiscal and monetary expansion. However, when you look at what's happening on the ground, David, it's completely different.
I think we can already be certain that this is going to have a negative impact on China's economy, aside from the tragic human cost. I think the main long-term impact is going to be the diversification of supply chains. Companies are realizing the danger of being over-reliant on China for their production. And those which haven't already moved some of their facilities out of China due to the U.S.-China trade war may be considering doing so now.
There is a mania going on right now in tech. Mm-hmm. Everything is stretched, like really, really stretched, because all the money is just flooded in, right? It's the place to make money right now. At some point, those multiples just are going to be too high.
Is it?
At some point. Look, the momentum trade reverts on a regular basis, and momentum traders get crushed.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, stocks finished the week on a down note as worries over coronavirus continued to weigh on the market. Despite all of that, we're seeing a pickup in the economic numbers, especially the Philly Fed this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. My good friend Ralph Ancampora will join me. Ralph is expecting a short-term correction, which is we're seeing play out now, but he thinks higher prices are ahead, with one caveat. Also, Frank Holmes will be here from U.S. Global. Frank's positive on gold and copper. As gold prices begin to surge, we are now well over $1,600 an ounce. And Rob Bernard from Financial Sense Wealth Management will join us as we discuss how local politicians are leveraging up debt at the state level. And later on, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro as they discuss the risk of bond ratings. But first, let's go to Ryan Poplava for an update on stories driving this week's markets.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, let's talk about Apple's revenue warning, a rally in the safety trade, and a summary of economic news recently, which were all big contributors to the financial markets this week. The U.S. market kicked things off on Tuesday when Apple unsurprisingly issued a revenue warning for the March quarter. They cited forced store closures and weak staffing levels at manufacturing sites of its suppliers. Yet despite well-known knowledge of these things back in January when we first heard of the coronavirus, Apple's stock has continued to rally higher. That said, Apple said outside of China, customer demand for products and services has been strong and in line with expectations. So as long as investors believe the coronavirus will be contained and only affect China, investors continue to follow the momentum in technology and the mega cap names to higher highs. This week, Tian Yang, the head of research at Variant Perception, told FS Insider listeners that the consensus forecasts for the coronavirus impact on China are too optimistic, and that basic math shows they are facing a very big hit to their economy and will likely take longer than expected to recover. The People's Bank of China has been aggressively accommodating via the special lending, which I talked about last week and started last week, and then as well as the cut in interest rates this week. So they've been aggressively trying to accommodate and help in things. And, you know, ever since the Chinese market opened up after their holiday, you know, the Chinese stocks have rallied strongly. So, and that's kind of coinciding with the accommodation we've seen from the People's Bank of China. Despite the momentum we've seen in the mega caps and technology sector to new highs, there's been a stealthy rally in safety assets, and it's become loud enough that investors are taking profits in stocks this week. Gold and gold miners started to rally significantly on Tuesday on the news from Apple and with a small correction in the market, and all throughout this week, propped up by concerns over the coronavirus spreading more significantly, and those are some things we've seen in Japan and South Korea recently, and also due to central bank accommodation, like I already mentioned. Now, the treasury bond prices continue to go up in 2020, with the 10-year yield back down below 1.5% as prices rise, interest rates fall. The dollar, too, has been rallying all week until the flash market PMI report disappointed on Friday. So something has to eventually give here. Either the safety trade investors are wrong, jumping in early in anticipation of a correction, or investors are wrong buying stocks aggressively on any dip, including the one on Tuesday with Apple's news. Let's talk about some of the economic releases, because until the flash PMI report on Friday on manufacturing in the U.S., the news has been generally good. The New York Empire State Manufacturing Survey on Tuesday had a big jump with a big pickup in demand, with double-digit surges in both new orders and shipments driving that growth. Now, the Producer Price Index came out, I think, Wednesday. That shot up about 0.5%, stronger than expected, attributed to a jump in final demand services. But this wasn't enough to worry investors over a Fed hike. I think the year-over-year comparison, which was very easy given our January in 2019 and where things were at that point in time in the economy after a 20% correction in the market. You know, the year-over-year comparison right now, I think, is around 2.1%. And, you know, with the Fed saying that it requires us to be above their target for a consistent amount of time, it wasn't enough of a big push in the Producer Price Index to really worry investors that the Fed would begin raising rates anytime soon. Construction is strong. It dipped very slightly in January after huge gains in December, but if you follow the trend, higher highs in construction month by month, which has all been based off of, you know, that low interest rate environment that we currently have and a strong consumer. Another regional survey that came out later in the week was the Philadelphia Fed survey, which jumped in February, giving us a strong positive note that the trade agreements between the U.S. and China, as well as the U.S., Mexico, and Canada agreement, are showing some fruit in manufacturing. Again, which is odd that the flash market PMI came out on Friday contracted at a reading of 49.6, down from 53.3 in January. So the first time that we've seen, I think, a dip like that since October of 2013. And that took stocks down more significantly on Friday. Of course, we also heard more coronavirus concerns, you know, not being as transparent and under-reporting in China, and then also hearing from South Korea as well as Japan of more cases more significantly. But let's talk about one more economic number, the all-important Conference Board leading indicators, which significantly rose in January, up 0.8%, with low jobless claims and more building permits being the primary contributors to that growth. Manufacturing was mixed, mainly due to the 737 MAX. I think once that gets resolved, we've been hearing maybe towards the end of the first half of the year, that should hopefully play into better manufacturing beyond what we're seeing elsewhere. Consumer expectations remain positive and contribute to a good reading overall. That's it for this week. You know, I think the technical catalyst will be speaking loudly here over the coming week ahead. You know, we hit short-term support in the S&P 500 right around 3,335, which was where the January highs were and should be support. Now, if that level breaks, I think short-term test of 3,200 is really in view, and the next level I'm watching right now. Pay close attention. You know, there's this divergence in the communication coming from the market. We've got a safety trade that's doing very well, stocks and technology stocks that have been doing very well until Thursday and Friday. It's a close fight. You know, who will win? Stay tuned. Next on the show will be Jim and Ralph Akampora to shed some light on that very subject.
Jim O'Sullivan, the chief U.S. macro strategist at TD Securities and also the most accurate forecaster in America over the past 10 years, according to MarketWatch, had this to say on our show this week.
The trend in inflation has been running below 2% for the last several years. I mean, it's basically been averaging about 1.5% using the PCE price index, the Fed's preferred measure. And frankly, they're not going to raise rates unless inflation goes to 2.5% or higher. So I think when people in the markets hear that, they're basically viewing the Fed as having really one-sided risk. The Fed's not going to tighten. They could just sit here for a while, or they're going to ease. And I think that's a very positive backdrop for financial markets in general.
Jim gave listeners a full macro update on the U.S. and global economy for this year. We also talked about employment, consumer spending, monetary policy, and much, much more. If you want to hear this full interview, in addition to all of our other interviews airing 3 days during the week with book authors, investment strategists, and industry experts across the globe, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
The market's going through a little corrective phase here. Last year, we were worried about trade. This year, we're worried about the coronavirus. What does all this mean for the market? Well, let's find out with my guest, Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, I know you're a big follower of the one of the oldest technical theories out there with Dow theory. So let's begin with the Dow, because while the industrials were heading off to new highs, the transports were lagging.
Well, if you want to just talk about Dow theory, the actual transportation average made its last closing high was actually in September of 2018. So all of the progress that the industrials have made, making all-time new highs, hasn't really been confirmed by the transportation index. I don't lose sleep over overnight, but I keep my eye on it anyway. I want to see that confirmed at some point. But in the meantime, the market has been very, very strong, and the leadership has been impressive. Well, you know, the thing that really impressed me was what happened at the latter part of last year, October, November, December. We started to see rotation into the financials, into the smaller mid-cap stocks. Even the emerging markets were doing well, and what had put crimp in the foreign markets was, of course, the virus. And no one could foresee that. So I think those markets will have to deal with that for a while. I'm in the class, I guess, it's saying that it will pass and we'll resume again. But in the meantime, the U.S. market is the strongest market in the world.
And, you know, as we take a look at this, the one thing that really struck me from October to December last year, which you just touched upon, was how broad the upsurge was. In other words, it started expanding into other sectors. It started expanding in overseas markets, where prior to that, Ralph, it was kind of like sort of defensives like consumer staples, utilities, and REITs, plus technology. Then it expanded out. So when you see this broad swath of upsurge in different sectors, does that give you more confidence that the bull market has more legs to it?
Absolutely. I like to use the phrase, a secular bull market thrives on rotation. You need the rotation. And if you look at the last couple of years, especially 18, 19, you know, the groups that we were just talking about, like financials, they were lagging, and the industrials were lagging. Gold was lagging. And as I mentioned, it was the latter part of last year that I saw that changing. I think there's still quite a bit left. In fact, even with today's sell-off, ones that did better, actually, relatively speaking, with the smaller mid-cap stocks, the Russell 2000. And that was part of that rotation that I started to see late last year. And I don't think, you know, today's action or, well, let's be honest. I mean, the market is a bit stretched and we need some kind of a correction. Even with the corona scare, and we lost 600 points that day, I was quoted as saying I'm looking for a deeper correction. Short term, you know, not bearish, but And I have egg on my face because the next day the market turned around and made new highs and a couple of days later. I mean, I think that shocked everybody. I know it shocked me. And everyone tells me that underneath the surface, the market really has a lot going for it.
If we just take some of the stocks in the Dow, Ralph, where are you going to get yields like you can get on Pfizer, 3M, and IBM when on the day you and I are speaking, we've got treasury yields on the 10-year note down to about 1.5?
Oh, man. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. That's the big kicker. And even in the utilities, as stretched as they are, I mean, you're getting yields there that you can't get anywhere else. You're right.
You've been around long enough. You've seen these bull markets. I wonder if you might just speak a moment, Ralph. There was a period of time, especially after the Great Depression, coming out of World War II, people would be surprised, like today, you were getting higher yields on stocks than you were getting in the bond market, which is the case for a lot of the stocks in the Dow today.
Yes. If I can digress a little bit, my career took off in 1995 when I wrote a report called Dow 7000. Everybody thought I was out of my mind that Dow was around 3,800.
I thought you were out of your mind.
Yes. But what I did is I went back and did the research. And the oldest, maybe I've said this in the past on your show, but I the oldest living technician that I ever met was a man by the name of Ken Ward. And I asked him, I said, "Mr. Ward, what was the most difficult market you ever had to deal with?" And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir. That had to be the crash of 29, because he was there for that." He said, "Oh, no." He said, we lost some money, but that wasn't the toughest market. And then he kept saying that the toughest market was the early 60s. I said, "But Mr. Ward, it went up." He said, "Oh, yes." And fooled everybody. We never believed it. Sound familiar? They fought it all the way up. So in my report, that Dow 7000 report, what I did is I went back and read every Wall Street Journal every day from 1960 to 1966. And I found that the reason for that strength was low inflation, low interest rates. Guess what? We had it in the late 90s and we have it today. That's the fertile ground that secular bull markets grow in.
And you know, I don't
see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah, because like the 60s, as your friend told you, and as you found out reading the Wall Street Journal, there was skepticism all the way up. Mm. And this is, what do we see today? It's probably one of the least loved bull markets I can remember, at least in my career.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, brutally honest, there were times when I was nervous, you know, in the decline in late, what was 2018? Remember when we get that sell-off going into, you know, I was looking good there for a while. I was calling for a correction, but it turned on a dime and just took off, and that I think spun a lot of people's heads. Yeah, this is different in the sense that the corrections, yes, we should have them. Hopefully, they're brief, and so far they have been, and you still see that money on the sidelines coming in. So I don't see any of that changing anytime soon.
And the other thing, you know, the expression, Tina, there is no alternative. I mean, we've been talking about dividend stocks. So let's just imagine you're retired. What are your choices? You can go into a 10-year treasury note at 1.5%, but 10 years from now, it's still going to be 1.5%. You can buy a utility stock, one of the Dow stocks. You'll probably get more in dividends than you're getting on the treasury. More importantly, 10 years from now, you're going to have a higher level of income.
Well said. Yes.
And that is something that, you know, I bring this up and I tell people to listen. I interviewed you in the summer of 2018, and at that time, you were predicting a correction in the market, a major one, which, you know, you looked damn good because sure enough, at the end of September, leading into the end of the year, we had a sharp sell-off. Mm-hmm. But I asked you a question and it always stuck in my mind. What do you do when you see these? And you told the story about you and your wife. Many people may not know. She was a broker on Wall Street. She loved dividend-paying stocks. And you went into a lot of dividend-paying stocks, and you kept them.
Oh, yes. My wife tells me, go away. we're not selling them.
Oh, come on. She's got to let you have a little money to trade with. I mean,
oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, she gives me a few dollars to... We've been very big on technology stocks, and recently started to look at an old favorite of mine, GE, which had been beaten down so badly. I think that's an interesting stock, fundamentally and technically.
When you see things that go to extremes, I want to talk about reversion to the mean, and I want to talk about one sector here that's gone. It always operates on extremes. Either it's way overvalued, way too high priced, or it's way too low and underpriced, and that's energy. I'd like to get your take here because, you know, I've been following energy for decades, and Ralph, it either goes to extreme on the upside, think of 2008 when oil prices got to 150, or in the fall of 2014 when oil was at 110 before it went into a bear market, but it operates on both ends of the extreme. When you see these kind of extremes, what do you do?
Well, I think you take advantage of them. The oil prices have been down here for quite some time, and of course you have a lot of political controversy going back and forth with the Middle East and all what they're intending to do. But I tell you, I think if you're long-term, start looking at the energy stocks. You know, I'm looking at crude prices right now. Light crude is around $53. The low in 2018 was around $44, $45. I don't see it getting down that low, but I think nibbling at this point right now, I think longer term would be an interesting area to get in.
Yeah, because, I mean, some of these high-quality blue-chip stocks, whether you're looking at Exxon, Chevron, British Petroleum, I mean, you've got dividend yields in the almost 6, 7% range. And that, you know, in this kind of market, when you have 1.5% treasuries or below 1% at the bank, that looks awfully promising.
Yeah, and I'm looking at Exxon right now, and it's had a bad couple of weeks here, but it's getting back to its 2010 low, somewhere at around $55, and the stock's about 59 right now. Yeah, start nibbling. I would.
Let's talk about something else. I mentioned that treasuries are down to 1.5%. We've got this little short-term correction that we're going through, especially on the day you and I are speaking on a Thursday. We had a correction. The market was down for the day. And you're also seeing a little bit of movement back into what I call the safety trade. You've got staples, rates, utilities, bonds doing well. And then you got the price of gold. What is that telling you?
Well, gold has been doing pretty well for a while now, even when gold can go up and stock prices move up simultaneously. Today was a different story, of course. There was a little concern. I'm not too sure why we had the sharp sell-off early. I suspect that it had a lot to do with the Fed coming out and saying, well, we're not going to cut rates. I don't think Wall Street liked that. And then the virus, there's more commentary about the coronavirus. So, gold will react, and it has. But if you look at gold over the last year or so, it's in technical parlance, it built a very nice bottom. And we've been talking about gold to my friends and clients for the last, the last 6, 7, 8 months. I think gold might be a little ahead of itself on a very, very short-term basis, but I think it could easily retest its all-time high back in 2011, somewhere in 1900. I think that's very, very doable, maybe even new highs.
Wow.
Too.
So as you look at this market right now, we've got a little hiccup here, a little correction, but as you look underneath the surface, whether you're looking at your intermediate charts, your long-term charts, the way the market is responding, the small caps, the emerging markets, the overseas markets, everything looks good to you?
Collectively, yes. Can we have another scare with the virus and all? Oh, absolutely. But I think under the surface, the leadership looks very, very healthy, and I think I see higher prices. If I had to give you one point that I look at carefully, and that was when we had that 600-point down day on the Dow, that was January 31st. That, to me, would be the near-term low that I would keep my eye on. As long as we stay above that and we're choppy, I have no problems. If we were to, at some point, close below that, I think it would bother me a little bit. I'd say that we've made an intermediate term top. But I can't say that today. I think this is just a lot of short-term volatility. And I'm loving it because, we keep saying we need a correction. And once you get the correction, everybody goes into a fetal position. Oh, my God, the world's coming to an end. No, just let it consolidate. That it needs to do that. Again, I'm talking like a technician. I'm saying, we've when I look at charts like forget Tesla. I mean, I get a nosebleed looking at that one. But you look at the Microsoft and the Apples, and I mean, they've done so, so well. There's nothing wrong with them, but they're ahead of themselves. So we need a pullback. I think it's
encouraging. And so for those that own blue chip stocks, I assume you're, and especially those that are paying good dividends, I think your advice would be what your wife has always done for you guys and her clients, which is just stay the course.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're seriously long-term, okay, then and you're capturing yield, well, you're going to live with price fluctuation. The reason why you're in there is you're in there for the return. That's the primary. And if we were to have, at some point, it's out there somewhere, we're going to have a bear market down 20% or so, I would add to those positions if they're the quality stocks that I'm assuming you have, yes. Trading them in and out, that's a different
Yeah,
mindset.
You've got to be right on getting out and right to get back in.
Exactly.
Ralph, as we close, I want you to tell our listeners something that I'm excited about. You're working on a video book. And for those of you that haven't seen this, Ralph, I hope you send me this a picture. You have a barn on your farm, and you have now completed a candlestick history of the Dow going back to when?
It's the entire history of the stock market, starting in 1871 with the Cowles Index. That's spelled Cowles. Alfred Cowles in 1932, I believe, wanted to he said Yale University, a very serious man, a researcher, and wanted to collect the best data he could on the stock market. And he went to all the newspapers, et cetera, and he decided that the best data started in 1871, where they can collect prices and dividends and capitalization. In fact, the Cowles Index in 1957 becomes the S&P 500. So as I go through this 1970s and 80s, 1896, that's when the Dow Jones Industrial Average comes out. I have the Dow Jones Industrial Average monthly from inception all the way It goes right around the entire barn.
Oh, my goodness.
Plus, I have all of the recessions annotated. I have all of the presidents annotated. By the way, if you go on YouTube, very, very dear friend of mine, Bill Keller, came. He's with Stock Charts, and they came to the barn in October, and they interviewed me. It's a 15-minute interview. Just look it up. It's called 50 Years.
50 Years?
On Wall Street. YouTube. Yes.
On Wall Street.
Go on YouTube, 50 years on Wall Street. 50 years, yes.
Okay.
And you'll see Keller's interviewing me, and then we walk around the barn. You know, I think you get a kick out of it.
You know what we're going to do? Ralph, send me a picture. Last time you sent a picture, you weren't quite done. What we're going to do is take that picture, and then we're going to include a link to that YouTube video, and we're going to put it on our website.
Okay.
So if you're listening.
Okay, you know what else? I'll send you the corner of the barn where I capture the Roaring Twenties. Now it goes up 500%, and then the major. Then you see the crash of 1929. Mm. Oh my heaven!
Oh, I'd love to see that.
It's really, yeah, I have it. I think you get a kick out of that.
Oh, I'd love it. And
I'll send it to you.
Okay, and then tell our listeners you are coming out with a video book. Let's talk about that.
Yes. Well, the dean of St. Thomas University came out with some of the students, and I was showing her the wall chart, and then she turned around to me and said, "Most students don't have a sense of economic and market history. And here you have it on the wall." I call it data visualization because you see all the data. I have all the percentage moves annotated and everything. I have historic events for each year. I have these plastic labels made and they stick on the wall and it's permanent. And she encouraged me to do a video book. I don't know what that is, but I'm doing it now. Perhaps Dave Keller will come out with the camera again. And when I'm finished writing the book, we'll do a video of, you know, different parts, and I'll stop and say, "Well, in chapter one, we have this, and look at what it looks like on the wall."
Wow!
Very, very exciting.
Yeah,
I'm really pumped.
Okay, well, listen. As soon as that comes out, I want you to contact me, and we'll talk about it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Definitely.
All right. Bye bye.
The consensus is too optimistic when it comes to the coronavirus's impact on China, and they're likely to see a very big hit, greater than what is expected in the first quarter, and a rebound in their economy is not likely until at least the second quarter, if not the second half of this year. That is the opinion of our guest, Tian Yang, head of research at Variant Perception.
There's some simple kind of back of the envelope math we can do to get a rough sense of this. So like 80% of GDP has seen a holiday in Hubei province where Wuhan's located. It's actually been a 14-day extended holiday. So if you just think mechanically, you know, there's typically about 90 days in a quarter and you lose 10 days from that, that's obviously already an 11% drop. And so if, say, the factories stop and, you know, the secondary kind of manufacturing sector of GDP is about 40% GDP, it would work out as about a 3.5% hit to growth alone. And obviously, there will be knock-on impacts to consumption and so forth. So given that China's got a 6% GDP growth target, and you're going to mechanically take off 3.5 points on an annualized basis, this suggests that we're probably going to get a number a lot closer to zero than six when the numbers do come out. Now, obviously, I appreciate there's some concerns around politically, it might not be tolerable for China to do that. Chinese GDP tends to be thought of as a quite manipulated statistic. But I think the reality on the ground is that there's going to be a very big drop.
Tian also discussed an extended multi-month pause in the reflation narrative, what that means for emerging markets, commodities, as well as their outlook for a recession in the context of a number of leading economic indicators. If you want to hear this full interview with Tian Yang, in addition to our full lineup of interviews airing 3 days during the week through our website and a podcast app of your choice, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click where it says subscribe.
The price of commodities have been falling over worries over the coronavirus, but one commodity is standing out, and that's the price of gold. To find out where it's going, we're going to talk with Frank Holmes, USA Gold. Frank, let's begin with the price of gold, over $1,600 an ounce. What's driving this?
Well, I think it's just, no doubt the coronavirus is more serious than SARS, because you've had something like 9/11 take place in Asia with the cancellation of flights and trains and the whole city having a lockdown that's bigger than Chicago. And you put that in that context of the fears. And so I think that you're seeing some other factors that sort of concern. And you add on to that what's called PMI, which we talk about in your program all the time. And the PMI numbers were negative. Fortunately, this past month, we saw PMIs for America finally jump above 50 after the trade war was settled. And this is a very important for job creation 6 months out. But Germany still lacks, and Germany is still suffering. So I think that to the concern around the world is still the idea we always say at US Global that government policies are precursor to change. So we monitor both monetary and fiscal policies. And what we're seeing is there's still with the G20 a lack of will outside of the US government to use fiscal policy to stimulate job creation and economic prosperity, where the rest of the countries are using monetary, cheap money. And they're seeing rates fall to still, once again, negative rates. And as rates continue to fall negatively, you look at Greece. You know, Greece is the basket case not too long ago that was the contagion for all of Europe. And now rates are below 1%. This concept is making gold very, very attractive. Whenever you have excessive money printing, you have excessive use of debt to try to stimulate economic activity. Every cycle means you need more and more debt. And so thus real assets start to percolate and take off. And so I'm very, very bullish on gold. Some of the smartest guys like the Ross Beatty's of the world. Previous cycle, he played copper. This year, this cycle, it's all gold he's building as companies. And so I think that gold is a very important asset class. And most of Wall Street still don't get it.
Frank, let's talk about where gold is. It's at $1,600. Do you see in this environment gold breaking out and taking out its old record at around $1,900?
It's very feasible because the DNA of volatility of gold. It is a non-event for gold to go up or down 20% a year. And it's pretty well what the stock market is too. It's a non-event, which is called one standard deviation. Approximately 70% of the time, gold can go up or down, so can the S&P go up or down 20%. So one says, well, what would be the factors that drive that? A 20% move from these price levels would take it through 1900. So it wouldn't be outrageous. And it's not overbought now to do that. So I remain, you know, very, very constructive that gold is an important asset class. The other one, Jim, is there's so many times in your program we've talked about it, but you know, in the past 20 years, bullion has outperformed the S&P 500. Two, when it comes to the gold stocks, the best have been the royalty companies like Franco-Nevada. They've outperformed Berkshire. They've outperformed Buffett. They've done spectacularly well. And 80% of the time over the past 20 years, gold has been up. But you wouldn't think that when you hear CNBC talk about it or Bloomberg television. They're just pervasively negative. And I think that's really positive for your listeners.
You know, and what's really hard to believe, the price of gold was in the 1200 range just a couple of years ago, and now we're at 1600. Let me talk about another phenomenon that's occurring at the same time, Frank, and I'd like to get your thoughts here. And that's a movement at the same time that we're seeing gold move. We're also seeing the cryptocurrencies move. So explain that.
Well, there's a couple of factors there. The whole idea of the crypto world is a decentralization. And it basically says it's a way to protect yourself against that. But on a relative basis, the U.S. government is a phenomenal, it's the best world. So it's not sort of talk negative about America, but we have to start, all of a sudden start reaching out around the world. And one of the things where, like, it shocked me, and I was recently at the Satoshi Roundtable a couple of weeks ago in Mexico, is these machines where you can convert your Bitcoin into currency. And the growth of these machines is very, very high in Miami and in Orlando, Florida. So I asked why. And they said, why? Because of Venezuelans and Argentines. The government basically is destroying their currency with unprecedented printing of money, and they have controls. They can't take the money out of the country. So they mine in the cloud and they show up in Miami and Orlando, and they can convert their coins into dollars. And that's a way to protect themselves from bad government policies. In London, England, there's also a high concentration of these machines. And that has to do with several of the Eastern European countries, especially when you go to Ukraine or a place like that. You know, how do people protect themselves from bad governments with bad government policies? And that's what they do. So I thought that was interesting. Two, the coronavirus, it is impacting the supply side because of the shutdown in China. And so I think that that's an important thing to consider, that itself the Bitcoin supply is just not coming on stream. Well, that is taking place. So the third part is just the money printing. Every time gold has had a big rally, we see all of a sudden the crypto start having a big rally on the backdrop of monetary policies. And the fourth and last consideration is more and more governments are talking about crypto and blockchain and digital money. And as the Federal Reserve Powell said, that Libra, the coin proposed by Facebook, it was a real eye-opener and a shocker that made the government all of a sudden pay attention. They better do something and not be asleep at the wheel. And so the first thing they did was protest to try to slow down that process, because it would just be so disruptive to Visas, MasterCards, to everything in the world when you have data on 2 billion people. And all of a sudden, that currency, whatever is backed by, could become the new norm of the world. And so you immediately saw the Bank of International Settlements, which basically is the collecting agency for all 60 central banks that use them, going a huge campaign globally, anti-Libra. But it's a wake-up call. Things are coming. We're going to see more and more digital money. Right now in China, in fact, credit cards aren't used by very small part. One of my analysts was in China last year, and he couldn't use a credit card to get toothpaste and toothbrush. And they didn't take currency, and they only took like an iPhone, a payment. So they're already using that. 60% of the people in China, 1.3 billion, 4 billion people, are using their phones as a mechanism to pay their bills.
So I want to talk about another commodity. And speaking of the coronavirus, and that's been copper, it's in a downturn, concerns over what this is going to do to trade in China. But Frank, the thing that really strikes me, and most people aren't aware, we're running massive deficits in copper each year. And especially as we move more towards clean energy, which is electric vehicles. I mean, all this clean energy and this new technology that we use requires a lot of copper. And yet, copper is languishing right now over concerns over this coronavirus and what may happen to China.
Yeah, and I think it'll have one of a spectacular surge here when the sentiment changes. And I think it's really interesting. I was reading research this morning on the 10-year government bond in the U.S., and this concern is hitting new lows, very close to the 2016 lows. And mortgages are only 30-year mortgages are only 30 basis points above their all-time lows. I think they were 330. So I think we're looking at 360 right now range for 30-year mortgages. So when you go back in history and look when SARS was resolved, there was a huge 30% run-up in bond yields. So bond prices came off, yields went up. And I think this is going to happen with copper. I think it's going to be one of those great trades that will fool everybody because of the deficit in supply. So the other factor is PMIs will, if they keep changing on a positive note, like the U.S. has finally turned from negative to positive, Germany gets its act together, China turns with the sentiment between now and April, I think we could have a phenomenal May-June. And my favorite little stock in that space is Copper Bank. It's one of those great specs that have lots of copper on their balance sheet. They're in the U.S., a safe jurisdiction. Under President Trump, the EPA has been much more constructive in seeing the development of infrastructure spending, and they've been much more constructive on any mining projects rather than chasing things away. And I think that this is one of those companies that have huge multiple leverage of the value of the copper in the ground behind each share. This stock can go up tenfold. So things like that, where, if you're speculating, it has no debt. They're like the stocks that I sort of like. outside the Glencores. And I forgot to tell you that in mid-January, the cryptos took off. You can see on a 50-day moving average. And Ethereum has done a bigger move. And Ethereum is what we mine at Hive Blockchain. And Hive jumped 400%, fourfold, and went from trading 2 million shares a day to 15 million shares a day for the past several weeks. And there was big institutional selling all of last year. And the thing I forgot to share with you earlier is that every year I go to Harvard for a week with 180 CEOs from 50 countries, and we do case studies. And a year ago, only 10% were digital and blockchain. This year, 25% of the case studies we had to do were blockchain and AI. So there's something that's important that's recognizing that AI is very, very important. Digital currency and money is just going to continue to grow, and blockchain is going to become the backbone for a lot of financial transactions. So I remain very bullish and constructive in that space. And that's another reason why I made that investment in Goldspot, because of the first AI company to use for mining. And there's been some major discoveries made by Yamana, by Grand Columbia, and a new company going public called Newfound Gold, with a mega discovery using artificial intelligence and their 9 geoscientists to analyze and put together how to de-risk exploration.
Frank, do you think, getting back to gold and even cryptocurrencies, as we see more and more governments, whether it's in Europe and Asia, here in the U.S., go to massive deficits? I think we're up to $24 trillion now. And several of the currencies, whether it's the euro and the others, aren't holding up where gold is breaking out. Now you have central banks that are accumulating a large amount of gold in their portfolios, recognizing it's the ultimate currency. Let's talk about the impact on central banks, because they have huge pocketbooks.
Well, you know, it's a great question, because historically, when we have had this sort of phenomenon around the world of money printing, if you go back to the history books in the 70s, there wasn't such an OPEC cartel. There was many more currencies, the Italian lire, the French franc. We go on with them, and this was always money floating back and forth between who had better government policies. Today, the G20 act like a monetary cartel, and they're all about synchronized taxation and regulation. And I think that the first break in that armor is Brexit, getting away from the draconian civil law of the EU and their socialist policies. By the way, their PMIs have turned positive, and I think that may be one of those positive parts that's taking place globally for us. And I share with you that there's something going on this idea that we have to have better government policies, especially under common law countries. And that would be, you know, from Australia to New Zealand, Canada. And I think that maybe down the road, we're going to get our own cartel of common law countries, special trade and understanding with each other, because it clearly is where all the innovations take place. It clearly is where the freedom of the bill of formation of capital is easier. And everyone's trying to knock on the door to get into these countries where there's opportunity. So these are some of the big macro global things that I see that are going to be providing you with great opportunities.
Final comment. This year is a presidential election year, and we're seeing things, Frank, that we haven't seen, whether it was the election of Donald Trump in 2016. And now if we look at the Democrats, you've got the two leading candidates right now are a socialist and one of the richest men in the world. I mean, it's bizarre. But what impact do you think that would have if, for example, you would have somebody like a Bernie Sanders who would become president?
Well, they're just very angry people. I just don't think the American people, when it comes push to shove, are going to vote an angry person. It's just un-American. It just really is. You know, okay. The media do it because, you know, there's always this bias by media, a propensity to be biased towards socialism and socialist policies. But I really don't see him coming on stream with that. But I do think, you know, we have to be aware of Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg, how he does in that contest, because he's worth about $60 billion. Trump is worth $6 billion. So he can blow all of Trump's net worth and still have lots of money spending. And he did do a great job in New York City. And so I think that, you know, he's probably the biggest Democratic contender at this stage. And but I don't think he's media savvy the way Muhammad Ali was the greatest boxer in the world. Trump is media savvy, and he has his own Twitter following that trust him, and he's able to maintain that pulse, his hand on those constituents. And we've seen the, you know, the disaster of impeachment. It's one charade after another. And all those things only make him look smarter for his followers. And I think that that's what's important to recognize. In history of America, people vote for, first of all, it's jobs, it's economic prosperity and opportunity for economic growth and safety. They have to feel safe. And I think that there's no doubt that President Trump, with low unemployment, can show that and rising stock market, that growth. So I think that odds favor, if the PMIs remain strong, that he'll be reelected based on history. And we'll see how that unfolds.
All right. Well, Frank, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, you're a prolific writer. Tell them how they could do so, please.
Well, go to usfunds.com, usfunds.com, and sign up for the Investor Alert and Frank Talk. We write every week. We have about 50,000 followers in 180 countries. And I try to write about my personal experiences in travel. And we comment about the world of gold and China and Eastern Europe because we have funds there. And we also have tax-free, very stable money funds that for people to short-term bond funds for people to invest in. And we have GoAU, the first quant gold equity ETF listed on New York Stock Exchange. And you can read and learn more about that. And it's outperformed the GDX and GDXJ. And it's doing exactly as the model said it would. So we have interesting products like that. And also the airlines that I think that when the sentiment changes towards China, I think the airline stocks can also soar.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
You've heard an awful lot about the federal budget deficits. The national debt is now approaching $24 trillion. But what about the states? What's going on at the state level? I think you'd be surprised. A lot of states are adding on more debt, and they're not informing their voters of the consequence. Joining us on the program from Financial Sense Wealth Management is Rob Bernard. Rob, you've been studying a proposition in California, and let's talk about that because there's a lot of debt the state is proposing to taxpayers. They're not really telling them what the consequence and what the interest cost of all that debt is going to be.
That's correct, Jim. In true form, the state of California is a little bit deceptive in calling it Proposition 13. As most of our listeners know, Proposition 13 came about in 1978 to limit the amount of property tax that California residents pay. So it's really quite ironic that this new Proposition 13 has nothing to do with our property taxes indirectly. So Proposition 13 is a voter initiative. If it gets approved, it will allow the state of California to issue $15 billion of new California GO bonds, $9 billion for public schools, $6 billion for higher education. Total, after it's all said and done, after 30 years, this will cost California taxpayers approximately $26 billion. Okay? So one of the interesting things is that this is for, supposedly, to remodernize and build new facilities for schools. However, as many of my clients understand and know, school districts issue their own debt, which is way more efficient than the California issuing debt in the general obligation format. As we all know, those GO bonds may be used however the state wants to use the funds. Now, interestingly enough, we had gas taxes in California are now 41.5 cents a gallon plus the sales tax. Well, that was supposed to go for our roads, bridges, and such. However, it's not going into a separate infrastructure fund. It's going to the general obligation fund. And if you're a California resident, California roads are not being properly maintained. So here we go. More California tax for gasoline, higher tax for our licenses, and where does it all go? The train to nowhere? Promises of our roads and bridges being repaired. This has the same smell of all the other tax initiatives that California puts out. But keep in mind, the local school districts and higher education, the UC campuses and state university campuses, they can issue their own bonds and take care of a lot of their own facility financing needs.
Well, this is just another con job. California politicians are known for, you know, hitting the heartstrings. We're going to repair the roads, hence the gas tax, 2 years in a row. Then, or we're going to rebuild schools. And as you mentioned, school districts issue their own bonds. It goes into the general fund, and we know where that's going. It's going to welfare. It's government pensions. That's where the real money is going, but that doesn't sell well with the voters. So they bring up stuff like, we're going to make the roads, and anybody drives around, I don't care if it's Los Angeles or San Diego, it's full of potholes. And so the infrastructure is not taking place. The risk here is the amount of debt taken on and the future interest cost. And let's talk about another issue, another way that they do this so they don't have to pay out money. And let's talk about a Poway school district, which was a zero coupon bond, non-callable, that's going to come due, which is going to be almost $1 billion, which means if they can't refinance it, the homeowners in Poway could face additional assessments.
Well, that's right. I mean, if we go back to 2012, the city of Poway, or 2011, city of Poway raised $126 million for schools. Not a bad idea. However, the way they did it was zero coupon bonds or capital appreciation bonds. So what that is for our listeners, it's a bond that is sold at a great discount that at some time of maturity, it matures at par value. And so the school district doesn't have to pay ongoing interest. They save it to the end. Well, by saving it to the end, Poway School District is going to owe $1 billion because the underwriters of this security failed to mention to Poway that, hey, you know what? You could put a 10-year call provision on this so that in the event that you wanted to call those bonds back and refinance them at a lower rate, you could do that. But they didn't. So now they're stuck. They cannot refinance these bonds until they mature. So there's a new guy, a new financial advisor type of situation up in San Francisco that's trying to entice Poway to buy back the bonds at fair market value, thus heading off this $1 billion end of the rainbow type of a payment that they're going to have to do.
Well, this is something not just occurring in California. It's in New Jersey. It's in Illinois. So that's why, Rob, it's very important if individual listeners are investing in muni bonds, they really get an updated analysis, not just what the bonds were issued at originally, which was, you know, let's say you're using Moody's, Standard & Poor's, or Fitch. They'll issue a rating on the bond when it's issued, but they don't, it's rarely that they will upgrade the bonds until they or reissue another rating until maybe there's something changes. And it's usually on the downside, which is another reason why we use Bloomberg analysis when looking at bonds, because it's more up-to-date and accurate. I wonder if you could speak to that for a minute.
That's correct, Jim. I use Bloomberg a lot to understand the fair value of bonds and how they're rated. We have Moody's, we have Standard & Poor's, and then we have the Bloomberg rating. Well, the Bloomberg rating is a lot more up-to-date than stale ratings from Moody's and Standard & Poor's. And a lot of times, some of the bonds we buy don't bother getting rated because we review their prospectus and figure out that they may be 6-7 times over their interest coverage and really don't require a rating because these are school district bonds or facility bonds that get the revenue directly from the property taxes of the property inside those school districts or facilities that they're financing.
And it's really important to point here, you got to be careful when you're out there in the bond market because there's a lot of conflicts of interest and a lot of things that you aren't being made aware of.
One thing, vote no on Prop 13 would save taxpayers lots of money. The other thing to know too is that the state of California currently has $80 billion worth of debt outstanding and $42 billion approved but not yet sold. This will produce interest payments on a yearly basis of $6 billion that will come out of the general fund.
Mm. All right, Rob, listen, thanks for that update and have a good weekend.
Corporate debt levels are at all-time highs, and there's a big question mark on the minds of many analysts when it comes to what happens in the next downturn. We see some downgrades issued on investment-grade credit to junk status and how that'll ripple effect through the market. Today, we're going to discuss that in today's Smart Macro, where we discuss the fundamental analysis research that drives our decision-making and investment strategy here at Financial Sense Wealth Management with, as usual, our Chief Investment Officer, Chris Poplava. Chris, let's start off with your view on corporate debt levels, where they are, why this is, first of all, a red flag or something that we need to be mindful of, and some of the things that you're looking at when it comes to the next downturn on how to invest around this.
If you go back to the early 1990s, the average rating was not BBB, which is the lowest investment grade rating. I believe it was in the A quality, with the highest rating being AAA. And we've seen over the past 2 to 3 decades, the average quality of the investment grade corporate bond market deteriorate such that I believe now more than half of the entire U.S. corporate debt market is BBB, literally just one notch above junk. So the U.S. corporate investment grade bond market has really deteriorated in terms of quality over the last few years, and that's a concern. And what you always want to do is you want to get ahead of downturns. You want to get ahead of potential risks and identify them before they happen so that you can catch those turns and be preventative and miss some of the potential trouble. And the issue is if we have an economic recession, and we'll have one at some point, the business cycle has not been repealed. It's, obviously this has been the longest expansion, but eventually we're going to have a downturn. And when that happens, you see revenue decline for corporations, which means their ability to service their debt declines. Additionally, before that, often at times, we see the interest rates for corporate debt begin to move up relative to treasuries, which is really looking at the spread, which means the cost of financing is more expensive. And this will be significant because there is a tremendous amount of corporate debt that is maturing over the next 2 to 3 years. And if they mature at a point where they have to be refinanced with new debt at higher interest rates or at a time that we're in the midst of a recession, there's going to be some problems where I'm sure we're going to see a huge amount of downgrades. So you want to really pay attention, understand what it is that you own and when to sidestep the investment grade market and either go to cash or go to treasuries.
Okay, so as you said, the average rating in prior decades was AAA for the corporate bond market. We've seen a continued deterioration in that rating to the point now where most corporate bonds are rated BBB, which is one mark above junk. Chris, before we get into this conversation a little further, would you mind telling our audience, giving us a little bit of education background on the different ratings? I know there's several rating agencies going from A or AAA down to junk status. Can you give us a little background there first?
Sure. The investment grade market is rated from BBB minus all the way to AAA plus. So you have AAA, AA, single A, and then you go down to BBB plus, just regular BBB and then BBB minus. And below that, anything that's BB plus all the way down to single B minus is considered junk. And below that is considered distress. So that would be anything triple C and lower. And there's a couple of rating agencies. The most well-known is Moody's as well as Standard & Poor's, but there's also a few other ones, including Fitch. And one of the ones that I'd like to talk today about is the new rating system that Bloomberg provides, which I believe provides a lot of key advantages that you do not have from the other rating agencies.
Okay, so to set the tone here, what we're talking about is the fact that corporate debt levels are at record highs. We're currently seeing record low interest rates, which means that it's easy to finance these corporate debt levels because interest costs, the cost of financing this debt, is very low. However, there's a risk here when we see interest rates go up. Then that makes the cost of that debt more expensive. And then in addition to that, if we were to see a recession, a downturn, what we're looking at is the chance of this debt, most of it being one notch above junk, triple B, being downrated to junk and how that will lead to a wave of selling. So give us an idea how to conceptualize this.
There's an arbitrary line in the sand between investment grade and junk. And there are a lot of institutions, insurance companies, pensions, foundations that have an investment mandate that they are prohibited from owning junk bonds, which is rated double B and lower. So if you look at historical default probabilities, the default probability does not materially increase going from triple B, which is the lowest tiered of investment grade, to double B plus, which is the highest tiered for junk status. And looking at historical data that Bloomberg has created, their historical default probability looking at the lowest tier of investment grade is a one-year default probability of 0.3% to 0.52. It's not even a 1% chance of default within the next year for the lowest tiered of investment grade. Now, going to junk status, that default probability only moves up marginally from 0.5% to about 0.9%. So still, even with the highest quality junk, the odds of a default within 1 year are very slim. And so that's why when you look at that arbitrary line in the sand, to me, it really is arbitrary where there's not that much material risk above looking at the highest quality of junk versus triple B. That's an important dynamic. And the reason why this is important is there's this artificial segmentation of the market. So if you have an investment grade bond and you're an institution that prohibits you to own junk, what we often see is that when a bond gets downgraded to junk status, there is a wave of selling. And we saw some really notable downgrades just this week. We've seen Kraft Food Heinz was downgraded to junk status, and that's a consumer staple. It might come as a surprise to many that they are now considered a junk bond issuer. And we also saw Macy's, who we know they've got the trouble with the Amazon effect, where more and more of retail spending is going online. Macy's was also downgraded to junk status recently. So, you know, looking at that, the biggest issue is being stuck with an investment grade bond or a bond fund, and you start to see a wave of downgrades, which I believe would happen in the next downturn, and seeing a hit to your bond portfolio.
So in that case, as you're mentioning, you know, there's these three different rating agencies. They're the ones that determine whether or not a bond issue by a different corporation, whether it's Kraft and Macy's, as you just said, recently being downgraded to junk. They're the ones that make that determination. How often do they make that determination? Do they put these ratings forth? And I guess the bigger question is, how do we at Financial Sense Wealth Management deal with that when it comes to the bond portfolios that we manage and how we monitor risk for different clients that hold these bonds?
I believe there's some inherent advantages that Bloomberg's rating system has compared to the typical rating agency like Standard Poor's and Moody's. Number one is it's real time. A lot of the inputs that go into their model are based on the stock price data. We know that as stock prices fall, the odds of a potential bankruptcy increase or default because the stock is falling because more than likely corporate earnings are falling, which means the financial health of a company is falling. So they use the stock price. They also look at the insurance market, is essentially the default insurance, looking at credit default swaps on various issuers, what the credit default swap market is saying. And then they also look at key financial metrics, which are updated quarterly with companies reporting their financial statements. So the reason why I like that is you see some market level and you see some balance sheet data that is updated on a daily basis. And a lot of times with rating agencies, they won't do an upgrade unless there's a material change or a corporate issuer is coming to market with a new issue that needs to have a rating slapped on it where you get a fresh rating for a company. And so the problem is you may actually own some junk bonds, but the rating has not changed yet. So that's the risk of relying solely on Moody's and Standard & Poor's, is that there could be huge delays in the ratings changes issued by those issuers versus Bloomberg, which is updated daily.
So as you mentioned, the Bloomberg model for rating corporate debt, which we use at our company, it's real time. So you don't have to wait for a rating change from Moody's, Fitch, S&P, the major credit rating agencies. And at the same time, you can watch and see, is there a deterioration in the status according to Bloomberg's real-time metric? Are we starting to see a degradation in the credit of a company such that it warrants selling, perhaps even before we see a final determination
by the major rating agencies. So in that case, it sounds like it also can be a leading indicator as well, or as an early warning system that you can use for rating debt. And I know we'll go into that a little bit later with Lehman Brothers, but what would be another major advantage that you'd see with Bloomberg's model versus the other credit rating agencies?
One of the biggest ones, which to me is equally as important as the fact that it's real time, is that, there's no inherent conflict of interest. We all know what happened in the last downturn where the rating agencies slapped AAA ratings on mortgage-backed securities that were inherently junk, and a lot of investors lost a tremendous amount of money. But if you're, for example, Moody's, and you are starting to give sub-AAA ratings, well, your competitor is probably going to steal business because you're not giving the rating that the issuer wants to receive. And so there is that risk that if you are too harsh with your rating, that you may lose business. So there is, in my opinion, that inherent conflict of interest. And I think we're seeing that again. I mean, for example, if you look at corporate balance sheets, I believe it was Morgan Stanley that did a study last year, which was cited by Jeff Gundlach as well as Dave Rosenberg, who we've had on our show, where it was looking at, I believe it was Fitch's metric for how they rate bonds based on leverage ratios. And when they looked at the leverage ratios of the investment grade bond universe, what they found based on Fitch's criteria was that there was a fair amount of investment-grade bonds that really should be considered junk. And the question is, why aren't these being rated junk right now? And I believe that part of that is that inherent conflict of interest, where if they're going to start to rate bonds junk, which that means the issuer is going to have to issue the debt at higher yields, then they're going to lose business. You don't have that issue when it comes to Bloomberg's rating. Bloomberg's rating is based on financial statements data as well as real-time market data, and they're not rating companies and getting a fee for that. So I think that is just as equally as important as the fact that it's real-time, is that I believe it's unbiased. So that's why I feel that you'll get an early warning with those questionable bonds that rating agencies are loath to downgrade for losing business.
Well, and that was one of the things that came up during the housing bubble, right, was when we saw a lot of this mortgage-backed security debt that was being sold at AAA rated and why it wasn't being downgraded. I remember the rating agencies definitely came under fire for how they participated in helping to blow up that bubble and perhaps not downgrading as soon as they should have, right? I mean, tell us a little bit about their role in that.
You're absolutely correct. You know, part of what you needed was you needed a willing buyer, you needed a willing seller. And as I was mentioning before, there's a lot of segments of the market that are prohibited from buying junk bonds or any kind of a bond, whether it's a mortgage-backed security, corporate bond, or even a municipal bond. If it's considered junk, they're prohibited from buying. So with all the debt that was being issued, the amount that was able to be purchased would have been lessened if you had that mandate where you had a lot of that mortgage-backed security debt that was issued at junk status versus investment grade. So I do believe they played a major role in terms of allowing that game to continue. So I think that would be another risk that we are going to find out in hindsight with the U.S. corporate debt bubble right now, is that the rating agencies were, again, way too lax with their ratings of the corporate debt sector.
Break this down for us in terms of what we're doing here at our company with how we monitor the risk of the debt that we hold that's issued by different corporations, where we look for value, and what gives us an edge when it comes to investing in the fixed income space.
So we use the Bloomberg rating system and we monitor it daily with our existing holdings to see what the risk is and whether it's improving or decreasing to warrant a possible sale of an investment from the accounts. And we also use it to help us to avoid certain areas that really are not investment grade. There's really two areas that we use it for. It's looking for bonds that are rated junk, that have junk bond yields. And what Bloomberg feels and what we feel based on our own analysis really should be investment grade. And that happens a lot where there's companies that have improving fundamentals, but the rating agencies aren't updating on a regular basis. So essentially what we want to see is the investment grade market where we feel we can get into an investment grade bond earlier than the market that's segmented and relies on either Standard & Poor's or Moody's data. And a good example of that was T-Mobile. T-Mobile was a bond that we bought for certain clients of ours years ago. And this was, they were rated junk because they issued a tremendous amount of debt to build out their mobile network. But after they spent the money to build all their towers, they started to see a pickup in cash. cash flow and steal market share from Verizon, AT&T, and eventually they were upgraded to investment grade. But we were buying a junk bond that, in our opinion, and Bloomberg's, was investment grade, but we were getting higher yields because of it was rated as junk by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. But we also look at it on the other end, where there's something that's rated investment grade that we feel isn't. So it helps us to avoid certain areas. A good example of that is going back again to the financial crisis. According to Bloomberg's rating system, the entire bull market, the prior bull market from 2002 all the way through 2007, Lehman Brothers was never rated investment grade by Bloomberg's system. It always had a default probability between 2 to 4 to 2 to 5% odds of default throughout that entire bull market, which would place them in the mid to lower spectrum of the junk bond market. And beginning in 2007, the default rating or risk of default jumped to 8%. And in early 2008, it was north of 10%, which meant a high level of potential of default and really was marked as distressed. And this all was shown in real time well before the rating agencies eventually downgraded Lehman Brothers and it was eventually taken over. So for us, it's, you know, avoiding some value traps and also being able to pick up some opportunities.
Do you have any more recent examples where we've been able to either buy a bond that's been undervalued or get out of debt on the flip side that was ready to be moved into junk status?
Sure. I think one that really highlights a lot of the points that I've made so far is a near-term bond by Tupperware, which matures June of 2021. Tupperware was rated investment grade last year. However, on August 15th, Standard & Poor's downgraded Tupperware from investment grade to junk, which is a BB+, so the highest quality spectrum of junk. And the bond fell from about 103 cents on the dollar all the way below 101 cents on the dollar. So there was an initial hit right off the bat. And that was likely for those institutions that rely on Standard & Poor's for the ratings to determine whether they can own something or not. And later on November 26th is finally when Moody's downgraded Tupperware from investment grade to junk. And we saw another round of selling of that bond where it was selling at 101 cents on the dollar and it went as low as 97 to 96 cents on the dollar. Bloomberg downgraded Tupperware from investment grade to junk on July 24th, which was more than 2 weeks ahead of the downgrade by Standard & Poor's. So that did give you an early warning. And on November 13th, they further downgraded Tupperware to several notches below the highest quality of investment grade. And again, that occurred prior to the Moody's downgrade. But what I really want to point out is, again, there's, you know, Tupperware is a good example of a lot of the points that we mentioned. Standard & Poor's downgraded Tupperware on August 15th of last year. The last time they had a ratings change for Tupperware was May 25th of 2011. So Standard & Poor's went more than 8 years with any ratings change on this bond. And we know with the expansion that there had to be some change in their balance sheet, the financial credit worthiness of this company, and yet there was no ratings change whatsoever. So we did not own Tupperware prior to the downgrades by Moody's and Standard & Poor's. However, Tupperware really caught our eye in December when the bond fell below 97 cents on the dollar. It pays a coupon of 4.75%. So the annualized yield to maturity of that bond, which is roughly a year and a half bond, was north of 7%. And the reason for that, again, is this massive wave of selling that occurred by those who are forced to sell because it fell below investment grade stance. And we were able to pick that up for our clients that were able to buy that. And again, as I was mentioning to you, there's really not that much more of a pickup and default risk going from BBB to BB+. It's very marginal, according to Bloomberg, where the chance of a default within 1 year is less than 1%. So it was highly attractive to us given where we're yields are. So, you know, our clients that were able to pick up the bond less than 97 cents on the dollar, they'll have a yield to maturity of north of 7%, provided Tupperware does not go into default. But based on their balance sheet and what we see for the company, that is highly unlikely in our opinion.
Chris, we've talked a lot about bond funds in our program in the past, and obviously we have Financial Sense Wealth Management. We invest and manage money across the asset space, so that includes equities, bonds, ETFs, individual stocks. We invest in commodities, a number of different things that we have at our disposal. You've been talking about individual bonds and how we can invest individual bonds that appear to be undervalued based on Bloomberg's real-time system again, how we can avoid bonds that may be about to be rated junk. This is a very powerful tool. But if you wouldn't mind, give us some background on bond funds, because since this is such a widely discussed topic and something we brought up in the past on our show, where do bond funds fit into our overall investment strategy?
There are times where our firm will invest in either a bond ETF or a mutual fund. And the reason for that is accessing certain areas of the market where we don't have an expertise or we don't have access to those markets or don't trade readily. You know, whether that be mortgage-backed securities or investing in emerging market debt, we might use a bond or ETF fund for that purpose. But also providing diversification. You know, when you get to the end of a business cycle, the odds of an individual issuer going bankrupt or even with stocks, finding a company that really starts to slide, you want to increase your diversification to reduce the overall risk in your portfolio. And for us, honestly, there's really a lack of yield in the investment grade bond market. And I think that's because of the demographic issue that we have as a country where we've got a lot of the boomers retiring when you tend to invest more in fixed income versus equity. And for that, you know, need for yield and income, it's created a huge demand for bonds. And so that's driven down the yields that we could get on bonds. There's normally a pretty strong spread relative to treasuries, but the spread currently, or the yield that you can get above a comparable treasury, is so low that, in my opinion, you're not really being compensated for taking risk by buying either long-term corporate bonds or just corporate bonds in general. So unless we can find a good bargain, we will, from time to time, use bond ETFs and mutual funds, and we will use those as long as we feel the risk of a market turn is not present or in the future. Currently, right now, as we've discussed in the past, we believe that we are going to see a reacceleration in the global and U.S. economy with obviously a delay to that recovery because of the coronavirus. But nonetheless, the recovery is still there and still has legs and room. The concern that we will have, again, as mentioned, is when we go into the next economic downturn. When growth slows, when the income for these corporations slows and their ability to service their debt declines, that is when we'll be looking to go into quality, which would be long-term treasuries, intermediate-term treasuries, and out of corporate bonds and also out of our corporate bond ETFs. But I don't feel that time is now. So unless I can find individual pockets of value like the Tupperware bond that we mentioned, we will use from time to time bond ETFs and bond mutual funds.
Well, Chris, for any of our listeners that are interested in how we can apply these tools to their bond portfolio or the positions that they hold, again, putting all the things that we discuss into practice, tell us a little bit more about what we can do for them and the best way to contact you.
For anyone that has a individual bond portfolio north of $500,000, we will provide a free risk assessment using Bloomberg system and put that alongside Standard & Poor's and Fitch, where we'll let you know what the status is based on Bloomberg and the one-year default risk that Bloomberg has. One thing I'd like to also mention is that, you know, in the last economic downturn, we saw a lot of municipal defaults, whether in Stockton or in other areas of California, and we know that Illinois is in deep trouble. Bloomberg also has the same rating scale system for municipal bonds. So if someone has a $500,000 or more municipal bond portfolio, we can also provide the same credit analysis. They can contact me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can give me a call at 888-486-3939 and just mention that you have an individual bond portfolio that you would like us to do some free risk analysis on.
Well, Chris, as you pointed out earlier, a very powerful tool set that we have available for all of you out there. If you want to take advantage of that, again, you can email Chris at chris.paplava@financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. Chris, it was a pleasure speaking with you. We look forward to speaking with you the next time.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.